Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. Dr. Charles Biles will give us a preview of his Wednesday presentation on the Electoral College versus the popular vote. We'll get an update on library activities. We'll take a walking tour of Evergreen Cemetery. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more, that's on Juno Afternoon. Taking a look at the weather this afternoon, you can see it. Sunny with a high near 72. Tonight, increasing clouds with a low around 55, southeast winds 5 to 10. Tomorrow, rain mainly after 1 p.m. with a high near 58. Wednesday night, rain before 1 a.m. and then showers after that, and the rain could be heavy at times. Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Today in our Center for Health Journalism series on health and wellness in Native communities, we take a look at the connection between culture and mental health among urban Native people living in the L.A. area. On a summer evening in Los Angeles, men, women, and children gather in a circle as a group of men sing and drum. They begin with a round dance and then transition into different styles of powwow dancing. The social gathering is a service provided by United American Indian Involvement, which started in the 1970s to help homeless Native people living on Skid Row.
I get to relive my culture almost every week.
That's Dave Patterson, one of the dance instructors. Patterson, who's Sac and Fox and Kickapoo, has been teaching powwow style dance for 12 years. He says it provides balance in his busy life.
Go to work just like anybody else, make a living. The hustle and bustle, especially here in California, it's really fast. And so sometimes I need that break.
Patterson is among many urban Indians who are willing to travel long distances to get together with other Native people in L.A. County. MC of the class, Philip Hill, who's Navajo, says it's about more than dancing.
It helps our families here who may have over generations lost their identity to gain back that identity and to hopefully retain that knowledge to where they can teach.
That disconnect from Native culture and identity is linked to 1950s federal government relocation policy. Native Americans were encouraged to leave reservations, get jobs in major cities like L.A. and assimilate. Connie Fasthorse's family was relocated from the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota to California. The Lakota grandmother prepared food for the evening and brings children she knows to the cultural classes.
They have to learn it here, and they begin to feel pride in their Native culture.
Combining cultural components like beading, basket weaving, sage picking, and family activities into Western programs is helping produce better outcomes for individuals and families, says Dr. Carrie Johnson, the director of Seven Generations Child and Family Services at United American Indian Involvement. She says isolation is connected to child abuse, and they used to see many reports around the holidays.
Once we started doing this, and really a lot in the last 3 years, we haven't had one during the holidays.
Johnson is Wahpeton, Dakota. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and says about 3 years ago they started increasing cultural workshops after taking advice from their community advisory group.
This is really working. Most of them will have therapists, so they're in therapy, our care coordinators who then talk to them about the activities. We have a calendar of cultural activities. They start coming to all of them.
Back at the drum and dance class, So Yanez, who's Yaqui, Iroquois, and Navajo, says Native culture helped guide him away from gangs and addiction.
If I wasn't Native American and I was an addict, I'd have a lot less fair chance because I grew up with ceremony, I grew up with teachings, I grew up with songs, I grew up with the dance. So coming back to it gave it a reason to tie it all back together.
Measuring success can be challenging. That's why UAII is currently undergoing a 5-year study of the Drum Dance and Regalia program. The research will produce data on whether it decreases mental health problems and substance abuse. The research project will also examine assessments of social connection and cultural identity. A ceremony is planned Tuesday for the opening and renaming of a Seattle public school in honor of the late Native American educator Robert Eagle Staff. The school in North Seattle, Washington is named Robert Eagle Staff Middle School in honor of the educator who's credited with helping develop the city's Indian education program. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations. Support by the Association on American Indian Affairs Repatriation Conference, September 25th and 26th in Albuquerque. Journey Home, empowering indigenous communities in international repatriation. Info at indian-affairs.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, this afternoon's volunteer host, and with me is our producer, Jeff Brown, on the board. Thank you, Jeff. My first guest this afternoon is Dr. Charles Biles. He is Professor Emeritus of Mathematics at Humboldt State University, and he will be giving a talk at the University of Alaska Southeast on Wednesday evening on the topic of the Electoral College versus the popular vote. Well, welcome to Juneau, Dr. Biles. Let me just tell you, you're lucky it's sunny today, because if it were sunny tomorrow, folks might be a little pressed to come indoors. We've had a rather rainy summer, so it's great that you're scheduled for tomorrow evening. What time and where will your talk be?
It will be 7 p.m. tomorrow evening, and it will be at the Egan Lecture Hall in the Egan Room. Egan Wing, Room 112.
Okay, that's the classroom wing at the Egan Library, Room 112. So as a professor of mathematics, I'm interested what led to an interest in the Electoral College versus the popular vote. This, by some, might be considered a somewhat arcane and narrow area. Talk about your pathway into that interest.
Well, thank you, Lori. That's quite a question. I kind of have a backdoor answer to this. After retiring from mathematics, about 3 years later, I was talking to our grandson who was just going to start college, and I just got so envious. I thought, oh, I wished I were 18 again and starting college. And I thought, no, wait a minute, I can do that. I'm retired, and the California State University system has a wonderful senior program where for $51 I can take 6 units of credits. So that's like a free education. So I thought, what would I want to take? And I thought, I've never had a university course in American history. So that's what I'm going to do, take American history. So I started taking American history courses, and when I reached the upper division level, one of the courses was like Washington to Polk. The formal name of the course was Jefferson to Jackson. And for the course, I had to have a research project. And as a former mathematics professor, I thought it would be so cool to have a history project that actually involved a little bit of math. And I was very familiar with math and elections and the ballot. And just beginning to come into that scenario was looking at the congressional apportionment problem. And that's dedicated to how many seats in the House of Representatives does each state get. So I thought, well, let's start with the very first census taken in 1790 and see what our founding fathers did. So there was a lot written about apportionment based on the first census of 1790. And I thought, this was really cool. I wonder what they did for the next decade in 1800. I could not find anything written. There was nothing. So I thought, well, let's try 1810. Again, nothing. 1820, nothing. 1830, nothing. And I thought, I'm going to have to go back to the original Journal of the House of Representatives and the original Journal of the Senate and reconstruct the debates and see what was going on. And I thought, wow, what an opportunity. This is virgin territory. It's like a biologist finding a new ecological region with undiscovered species, and I thought, virgin research territory, this is an academician's dream. So I started with the history of congressional apportionment, redoing the 1790, and then 1800 and 1810, and I was so smitten, I had to keep going. So I just recently finished the 2010 census and put everything into a book and got that recently accepted for publication on the history of congressional apportionment. And it turns out that that's heavily related to the Electoral College, because the formula for the number of electoral states that each state gets, as you mentioned, is a little formula coming from the U.S. Constitution that says the number of electoral votes for each state is the number of national legislatures that the state has. So that's two. Every state has two senators, so that's an automatic two. And then add to that the number of congressmen in the U.S. House of Representatives, and that's the congressional apportionment problem.
And I'm sure you know that Alaska, along with Wyoming and Vermont, have some of amongst the lowest, if not the lowest, electoral votes because, of course, we have three elected legislators at the national level. And for folks who are listening who maybe need a little brush up, of course, the census is every 10 years and apportionment is where those voter district lines are drawn based on that census.
That's correct.
And then for a state like California or Texas, of course, they each get two plus their number of representatives. So they're massive, as well as New York.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your topic will be on the Electoral College versus the popular vote. So versus implies that they're competitive with each other. Explain what you learned about each and what the focus of your topic will be.
That's an absolutely wonderful question. I wished I would have had you as a student in some of my math classes.
Well,
I would have.
My area is history, not mathematics, but I do find history completely engaging.
The directives for the seats in the House of Representatives come from the U.S. Constitution, and the Constitution has three guidelines. And the first and most important one is that apportionment of the U.S. House of Representatives shall be based on population as determined by the decennial census. And decennial means taking every 10 years. And since the first census was done in 1790, that means every year ending in a zero is a census year. And the other two guidelines, the second one says every state will receive at least one representative. And by the way, there are seven states in that predicament.
Oh, they just have one.
Alaska and Montana, Wyoming, North and South Dakota, Vermont, and Delaware. So those are the seven states that have the honor of having exactly one seat in the House of Representatives. So adding the two senators that you mentioned gives them three electoral votes. And the third guideline from the Constitution says, but the size of the House shall not exceed one representative for every 30,000 people. Well, if there was one representative for every 30,000 people, the U.S. House of Representatives would be over 10,300.
It's unwieldy at 435.
That sure sounds unwieldy at 435.
But 10,000, that would be worse.
Oh, that would be quite something to imagine how that would operate. And 435, that's an interesting thing with regard to the number of seats in the House will be apportioned based on population. It doesn't quite work out that way. For example, comparing the largest state in the Union, California, to the smallest state, Wyoming. California has 66 times the population of Wyoming. But the Electoral College ratio is 55-3. So from that point of view, a resident of Laramie, for example, has 3.6 times the electoral power as me, a resident of Eureka, simply because Laramie's in Wyoming and Eureka's in California, and for no other reason.
Well, looking back at the genesis of the Electoral College, wasn't the intent to assure the powerfulness of small states so that they would not be run roughshod in elections?
That was definitely a factor, and that was the usual one that was put out for publicity, especially during the debates on whether or not to ratify the Constitution, was the protection of the small states. And this is very, very well understood, that the small states had a real fear of being dominated by the big daddy on the block, Virginia. At the time. And in order to assuage that fear, the legislature was broken up into two chambers, the Senate and the House. And the Senate was to represent the states. And each state has two senators. So each small state is represented to exactly the same level in the Senate as a large state. But in the House of Representatives, that specifically was to be a portion based on the population. So California has a population of 66 to 1 in comparison to Wyoming, and yet the representation number of seats in the House is 53 to 1.
You identify an inequity. Is that where your research has led you?
That is one of the places that it has led. And one of the surprising things for me is I knew fully well that the Senate was meant to create a safety base for the small states, but I didn't realize what a great advantage the small states had over the larger states in the representative in the House, just because of the specific rule that each state must have at least one seat. For example, based on the last census in 2010, given the U.S. population and then 435 seats in the House, on average, each representative is representing 711,000 people. But Wyoming's population isn't even 600,000.
And so it has an outsized proportional impact compared to those states where, for example, you compare it to California, where on a per-person basis, you have really less representation than a person living almost right next door in Wyoming, simply because of that popular population-based.
That is correct. And that weight favoring the small states is not only existing in the Senate, but also in the House of Representatives. And for two reasons, really. One is that the current House size of 435, that was first met in 1912. So that's been around a long time. And then in 1929, an act of Congress froze the House size at 435. So it will stay at 435 until Congress changes the law, and I don't foresee that happening in the near future.
So I'm thinking about the seven states you named that have just three representatives, one representative and then two senators.
Yes.
And other than Delaware, and to some degree Alaska because of our population of Alaska Natives, it seems to me that those states, which, as you've pointed out, have disproportionate representative in terms of a greater value per voter, are primarily white. Have you looked at this from an ethnic point of view at all?
No, I have not studied it from an ethnic point of view. My main point of view on studying it is when you went asked a question previously on where did all this come from? And going back to the framers and the founding fathers, they wanted to protect the interests of the smaller states, and they also wanted to have the educated, knowing people who knew about politics really making the decisions, and they wanted to screen the selection of the president away from the riffraff, and primarily that was one of the main rationales for the creation of the Electoral College, was to screen the selection of the president against the riffraff of the people.
And, of course, there were property ownership requirements as well as racial requirements,
which that is correct.
Provided barriers as well.
That was a really insightful viewpoint that you had there with regard to the racial ones, and it makes me think a lot of just suffrage, that is, the right to vote, because in the formative years in our country, the right to vote was extended to people who were white, male, 21 years of age, propertied, and Protestant. And, of course, there were exceptions in American history, but those were now famous in our textbook exactly for that reason, is that they're exceptions to those particular principles. Fortunately, we've come a long way in extending equality of suffrage. And in my personal opinion, one of the things that we need to do with regard to equality of suffrage is one last step, and that is to realize one person, one vote. In the whole process of apportionment, whether it's restricted to the House of Representatives or carried over into the Electoral College, it's been a dual-sided coin that I've noticed ever since the very first discussion from 1790, a struggle between fairness and power. And tough. Sometimes fairness wins and sometimes power wins. But the particular fairness axiom that's out there today in the media is one person, one vote. And unfortunately, that particular axiom stops at the state line.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Charles Biles. He is Professor Emeritus of Mathematics from Humboldt State University, and he will be giving a talk tomorrow night at 7 p.m. in the Egan Classroom Wing on the campus of UAS, and that will be in room 112. And Dr. Biles, I assume it is a free lecture?
That is correct.
And he has explained how he came to this interest when he went back to college after retiring. So should it be changed? Should we move to the popular vote?
That is really an excellent question. And in looking at each person, what they need to search is some of their own minds. And what is an election? What is it all about? What does a fair election mean? And there are some wonkish and academic and reasonable and analytic kind of reasons to go into. But for myself, when I enter the voting booth, in addition to my head, I can't help but engage my heart and soul, and the patriotic way the flag just comes out in me. And when I think of the beautiful preamble that we have to the U.S. Constitution of "We the People of the United States," I think that's never realized in any single office that we have, that is political office that we have in this country. Congressmen or representative are elected in congressional districts, senators by the state, but we have nothing that is elected on a national basis. Personally, just for my own personal opinion, I would like to see one person, one vote extended beyond the state lines and to the entire nation with regard to at least the selection of the president that I'll consider the national officer.
And of course, we have a president in office who won the electoral vote and did not win the popular vote. And I assume folks understand that's because if you win the vote in the state where you're competing, mm-hmm. you receive, in most of those states, the entire electoral college vote, which mm-hmm. again is equal to the number of representatives and senators that that state has in the national legislature. Mm-hmm. So while a candidate might lose by, say, you could lose by one vote,
yes.
and still your opponent would receive all of mm-hmm. those electoral votes. So if this were to change, how complicated is that?
It would be far simpler than it is today, and that's because on Election Day from November 10th, it's called National Election Day, and that's really a misnomer. It's simultaneous Election Day, where all 51 of the electoral states runs an election on the same day in order to decide what their slate of presidential electors for the Electoral College will be. Then later, the electors gather together and cast their votes, and those votes are gathered together by an appropriate state official who then has to submit them to the president of the Senate, who's the vice president of the United States, who calls a joint session of Congress and takes all the 51 electoral state certificates, announces them together, and whew, finally, if somebody gets a majority of that, then they're declared the president-elect. That's why responsible media sources always referred to Mr. Trump as the presumed president-elect until he was actually elected president. And then 2 weeks later, after the joint meeting of Congress, then he's actually inaugurated as president. So if we had the national popular vote, then things would end after the November 10th election, and we wouldn't have all the hoopla and pomp and circumstances involved post-election on gathering electors, creating the electoral vote, creating the state certificates, submitting that to a joint session of Congress, and then declaring the winner on that basis.
It does sound a bit arcane today in a world where our communications are much more rapid and our community is our country. Because of that ability to communicate more effectively, to have those various levels seems to provide kind of a distance between that popular vote and then the process to becoming president. However, it's very difficult to change the Constitution, and that's what would be required mm-hmm. to move from an electoral college process to a popular vote. What is that process, and is there mm-hmm. Any hope that it could ever happen?
It's very difficult to change the U.S. Constitution. In fact, from that regard, having a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College, I don't see that ever happening. One very interesting thing is the so-called National Vote Bill. That is one of those wonderful options where it's not the Electoral College versus the popular vote, where you have only one or the other. It's one of those cases where you can have both. You can have your cake and eat it too. That is, the reform can be done strictly by, first of all, keeping the Electoral College, which really has a big advantage, actually. The idea of a national vote, currently there's no national vote. It's a collection of 51 individual statewide votes that are added together. A true national vote would be more like a nationalized vote, and that's because the ballot in each one of the 51 electoral states is different. For example, three states in the Union only listed three candidates, Trump, Clinton, and Johnson, as presidential candidates. California listed five on the ballot, Alaska listed six, Tennessee listed seven, Utah listed eight, and Colorado had a Rocky Mountain High at listing 22 candidates on their presidential ballot. So would a national presidential election require a national ballot? What about write-in candidates, for example? Nine states refuse to have a write-in option on a presidential election, and that's because there are too many people that write in frivolous kind of choices, like Mickey Mouse always gets stuff, and so they refuse to allow write-in votes. Well, what about write-in votes? Those are controlled differently from state to state. So a national election does not necessarily mean we have to have a nationalized election. There is a movement afoot called the National Popular Vote Bill, and it would keep the Electoral College intact as is, and there would only be one change involved, but it would be up to each individual state involved, and that would be that a bill would be introduced in the state legislature where how is the electoral slate picked for that state? Currently, it's the plurality winner in that state, and what would happen in the National Popular Vote Bill, they would change the requirement from plurality winner statewide to plurality winner nationwide.
What would be the practical effect of that then in the Electoral College?
The practical effect of that is a consortium of states would be created, and the consortium would consist of all of those states that would pass the National Vote Bill. Now, part of the National Vote Bill is, when would this take effect? Just because a state passes the bill doesn't mean that it takes effect. The bill would take effect when the compact of states reaches a certain threshold level, and that threshold level is that the compact of states control 270 of the electoral votes. 270 electoral votes is the majority of the Electoral College. So if you get a compact of states, I think of the Mayflower Compact, for example, a compact of states that will agree. We will agree to assign our Electoral College slate to the national winner, not just the statewide winner, and because we control 270 of the electoral votes, voila, the national vote is selected.
So you're talking about a coalition of states
that
would agree to this.
Exactly right.
Would that not result in some disenfranchisement?
Disenfranchised, and then who would be disenfranchised?
Perhaps for those states that were not part of the coalition.
The answer is no, because they've lost. Any more than whenever a candidate gets 270 electoral votes, one could say that any of the states that did not contribute to the winning candidate, are they really disenfranchised? No, they've been on the losing side of the presidential election. They'll get over it.
Would it allow in any way the proportionate allocation of those electors, meaning that if candidate A got 48% of the vote and candidate B got 52%, that the electors would be split out that way rather than winner takes all?
If ever I go back into teaching, I'm going to send you a personal invitation to sign up for my class. That was a wonderful question. Should the electoral votes be given out proportionally?
Correct.
In every state at the current time, the electoral slate is given on a winner-take-all basis. There's only two exceptions, and those are Nebraska and Maine. And the way that they assign their electoral votes is whoever is the statewide winner gets two electoral votes associated with the senators. and then it's whoever wins the congressional districts. For example, in the last election, the state of Maine has two congressional districts. Trump won in one, Clinton won the other.
Oh, how interesting.
So Trump got an electoral vote, and Clinton got an electoral vote based on winning the corresponding districts. And that really sounds good. Despite the fact that it sounds really good, that is one of the options that personally I am deeply opposed to. And that's because of the problem of gerrymandering. The congressional apportionment only assigns the number of seats to a state, but it's up to the state legislature to decide on the congressional districts. Now, in Alaska here, it's no problem because Alaska only has one representative, so the entire state is a congressional district. And same with Montana and Wyoming, etc. But in the state of Washington, for example, there are 10 congressional districts, and it's up to the state to decide where there's congressional districts. In some states, for example, my favorite one to pick on is North Carolina. One can look at a congressional district map of North Carolina, and it's just absolutely mind-boggling.
It's like a centipede or something.
And it's there are some certain districts in Illinois that are poster childs for the very definition of gerrymandering. In my opinion, that's what would happen if electoral votes were given by congressional districts. It would just compound the problem of gerrymandering.
Interesting point of view. And, of course, a number of states' apportionment plans have been challenged both in the state Supreme Court as well as in the United States Supreme Court. We are talking with Dr. Charles Biles. He is a professor emeritus of mathematics from Humboldt State University, and he'll be giving a free talk tomorrow night at 7 o'clock on the UAS campus in Egan Classroom 112. And the topic is the Electoral College versus the popular vote. I learned a lot, and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's just been absolutely charming to be here in Juneau. I've loved it. And I hope that you appreciated that I brought my California weather with me.
Indeed, we do.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 4th of September, 2017. The city of Los Angeles was founded on this date, 1781. King Carlos III of Spain ordered it on the banks of a river. Population of 44 Spanish, soon joined by 11 families from Mexico. There was a Native American village there, but the newcomers brought European diseases, which wiped out the native population. Original center of the town, just north of downtown, near Chinatown, the site of the original Pueblo is now a parking lot. The first commercial electric power plant opened on this date, 1882, Pearl Street, Lower Manhattan. Thomas Edison flipped the switch. He had invented a reliable electric light bulb, and then he had to figure out how to generate electricity and deliver it to people's homes and invent the fixtures, the sockets, the fuses, the meters that would be installed there. He chose Pearl Street because it was close to Wall Street and he needed investors. It's the birthday of the novelist Richard Wright, Roxy, Mississippi, 1908, grew up in Memphis, and taught himself to read at the library, moved to Chicago, worked as a ditch digger, delivery boy, hospital worker, and a postal clerk, started writing his masterpiece, Native Son. George Eastman received a patent for the first film camera on this date in 1888. He called it the Kodak. It replaced the big box camera on a tripod that used heavy glass plates, so made it easy for ordinary people to take pictures. Camera used a roll of film that could hold 100 pictures. And it was on this day in 1957 that Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus called out the National Guard to try to prevent 9 black students from entering Central High School in Little Rock. In response, President Eisenhower sent in the 101st Airborne Division to make sure that they could enroll. And a few days later, he went on TV to say mob rule cannot be allowed to override the decisions of our courts. Here's a poem for today by Charles Rafferty entitled Drift. Long ago, the old friends stopped calling. I used to think they had lost my number. Now I forgive them, their children and their jobs, their wives and their divorces, their cancer and their lawns, the 15 minutes they allow themselves at the piano every night. I'm able to go on without them, a kind of orphan from the life I used to live. This is what I'm thinking as I get in the car to take my daughter to her voice lesson. The ride is a quiet one. She's getting older and has learned to keep things to herself. When we arrive at the lesson, she makes it clear, without saying so, that I should wait outside. So I stay in the car, doing the bills, doing the things I hate, as her high notes drift through the studio door, the glass of the car window, the air that will be between us now from here until the end. A poem by Charles Rafferty, Drift, from The Smoke of Horses, published by BOA Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Condor Airlines, introducing new service from San Diego, Pittsburgh, and New Orleans. More information on Condor's 12 U.S. gateways, available on condor.com, Condor, born to fly. And by Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for home projects from minor repairs to major remodels. See homeowner reviews, compare prices, and book appointments at homeadvisor.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Laurie Scandling. My guests are Robert Barr. He is director of Juno Public Libraries, and Beth Weigel, who is the program coordinator. And as usual, it is all happening at the library, and it's free. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the new digital database that is a new service. It sounds very exciting, Robert. Talk
it
about
is.
That,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, so we just went live on Friday, so it is brand new. It's called Canopy, and it is... You know, the best way that I've been describing it to people is it's like Netflix, except it has library content in it. So it has lots of videos that you can stream from anywhere for free as long as you have your library card. And so the videos that we're talking about here are it's mainly documentary content. Like if you're familiar with the Criterion Collection, it's got that entire collection. It's got a lot of independent films. It also has a fair amount of instructional content. So, like, there's this publisher called The Great Courses, which does a lot of really awesome content that focuses on like adult education. So you can think like college classes type of thing. You can stream those on it on Canopy. And so you would find that by going to our website, which is juno.org/library. And it's going to be featured on the front page, but right now you have to dig down a little bit. It's under the research tab under Canopy.
With a K.
With a K,
ooh,
yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Canopy with a K, the new digital video streaming service.
Yeah.
And you said primarily library content. So you would not find, for example, feature films on there.
No, you're not going to find feature films. You will find a lot of really great independent films and documentaries, though, that you wouldn't find elsewhere. Like it's really stuff that you're not going to find on sources like Netflix or Amazon Prime, that kind of thing.
And that goes live, or went live last Friday.
It went live last Friday, so it's live now. Yeah, you would just go there, and the first time you click on that link, it's going to ask you to create an account, and you tie your library card to that account,
okay.
And then you can just go straight there.
Beth, let's remind people, with school having started, what some of the resources are for students.
Well, we do have homework help, and you can that's another one of our services online, and you can actually connect with a tutor and send them your work, and then they can send it back to you. And so that's available. It's called Live Homework Help.
And is that obvious on the front page?
If it's not, it's under the kids' resources as well as in the database listing.
What else is coming up for kids?
Well, we do a lot of things monthly. We have our toddler times and story times that we were on a little bit of a break there at the end of summer reading, and now we're back in with our story times and our toddler times. And so Mondays are toddler times, both in downtown and the valley, and then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at 11 are story times at the various locations as well. And then we also have a Spanish story time called Cuento Cuentos Infantil. That's on Monday evenings. We have a Tlingit Language Learners group that also meets on Monday evenings at the downtown library. We do a family night. This month it's on the 21st at the downtown, and we're going to have some music with Patrick Tlaxa. It's part of the International Day of Peace and, of course, the start of the fall equinox. And there's some other things that really are fun that are going on for kids at the library once a month. One of our volunteers does an origami class this month. It's on the 16th at the Valley, and she does Japanese origami. She's going to focus on, usually she focuses on some theme every month. If there's a holiday, she does holiday. This month it looks like ocean life. We also have coding classes, and that can, you know, are mainly geared towards kids, and that happens monthly. We've also got some teen programming happening. There's an anime club that's meeting periodically this month.
Talk about the Harry Potter exhibit. What is
right.
that? Is it the display of books, or what else is contained in that?
So a few years ago, I went to a session at a conference by the Library of Medicine, and they have a collection of traveling displays or exhibits that are mostly panels that have information on them, but they create this really they have this really creative content in that they tie whatever sort of medical information or with something that's a little more popular, I guess. So this is all about ancient medieval medicines and tying it to the Harry Potter books, because in the Harry Potter books, Harry goes to herbology class, for example, and learns all about, you know, different herbs and how to use them to make potions and things like that. And so it has six panels, and there's a variety of content that talks about these sort of medieval medicines and how the book is using those different things. So there are some things that are real, and then, you know, some things that are made up in Harry Potter. But a lot of the stuff that they're doing in those classes with the different herbs and potions and things like that have some basis in medieval.
And that's downtown?
And that's at the downtown library right now. And then we'll move it out to the Valley Library probably in the middle of October or so.
Yeah. One of the cool things about that, too, is that if you go to the National Library of Medicine's website, they have more information about that exhibit, including lesson plans. So if you homeschool, or if you're an educator in the school district and you want to incorporate that into, it'd be great into like a social studies curriculum or a science curriculum.
Great lens to look at literature through. Speaking of literature, we have some authors coming. I understand we have a poet laureate of Malibu, the first to be.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that gentleman, and then talk about Rosemary Wells as well.
Yeah, so we have an author, a poet, an author. He does both. His name is Ricardo Means Ibarra, and he is the first poet laureate for the city of Malibu in California. And he's got a couple different books of poetry. One's called Beyond the Reef, and he's got a couple of children's books, but they're for probably a little bit, you know, middle grade kids that are fantasy-like type things and incorporate lots of interesting characters. He's done a lot of work, you know, with poetry programs in the schools, and he has a lot of inspiration. And so I think he's Chicano, and he's going to, I think, just bring a different perspective in poetry, and it's always nice to just have an evening of poetry at the library. So we're looking forward to having him here.
And Rosemary Wells, what is her area of focus?
So Rosemary is a children's author of many, many books, I think over 80. If you're familiar with the Max and Ruby series, she's the author of those. That's what she's best known for. And she's going to be here September 16th at 3:30 in the afternoon at the APK, State Library Archives and Museum, is where we're having that program. And so she's going to be giving a lecture about the importance of reading to very young kids and the benefits thereof. So this would be great for educators and for anyone interested in early childhood literacy. And she'll have her newest, most recently published book there, and she'll be doing a book signing. And it's the same day as the Preparedness Expo that's at Centennial Hall. So you could go to the Preparedness Expo, and then at the end of that, hop on over to the APK and see Rosemary.
September 16th. And I'm interested that you're linking the community read in part to the preparedness. Talk about the community read this year, what it is, and how folks can get a copy.
Okay. Well, we applied for and received a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, and it's for a program called the NEA Big Read. And the Big Read is a community reading of a book. And so we partnered also with the University of Alaska Southeast and their One Campus, One Book project. And the book that we selected is Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. And it's been around for a couple years now. And it's a really intriguing book because the whole premise of the book is that a pandemic kind of comes on really fast, and the end of civilization as we know it right now halts, and everybody sort of has to remake their worlds and their lives from who's survived. And so it's intriguing because she uses so much about art to interpret this traumatic, horrible event that's happened, and all the different characters and how they sort of end up where they end up and 20 years after the pandemic. So we get to kind of get a lot of backstory on a lot of the characters, and then we get to kind of see how things go down the night things start to change, and that we sort of see that line that comes, the before and the after the event sort of change and transition in people's lives, and then we get to see 20 years into the future. And we spend a lot of time following in the book a band of actors and musicians in the symphony troupe of actors that do Shakespeare, and so they go around from these new settlements to new settlements and perform. And one of the actors also has this comic book that's called Station 11 that she was given to by this other actor in before the pandemic, and it sort of serves as a guide for her to escape a little bit as well. And it shows up in different ways and how different people take this.
And when does the community read start of Station 11?
Right. So we're kicking things off a little bit closer to the end of the month officially, but we are going to be you can get your book now. So we have lots of copies of the book at the different libraries in town, including the State Library and the University Library. So you can, you know, obviously check it out through usual means or download it on Alaska Digital Library. But we also have free copies that will be circulating through the community. And so the official kickoff will be on the 29th here at the end of the month at the APK. We'll be having a panel of authors that are not necessarily associated with this book, but will respond to this book because they have work that's very similar to it. And the theme of the book that will kind of keep reoccurring is the theme of survival, whether it be emotional, physical, or cultural. And so they'll respond to the book and talk a little bit about their own work, which has themes like that. Don Reardon, Joan Kane is a poet, and Vera Starbard is a playwright. So that'll be at the end of the month. But we will be at the Preparedness Expo on the 15th and 16th handing out books because, you know, that's one of the reasons that we selected this book, because we see our community as this little place where, you know, if something goes wrong, then, you know, we're kind of on our own here. And I likened it to when we had the avalanche that took out our power, and we all had to kind of problem solve in order to figure out how to, you know, reduce our power and do with less and things like that. So I think it's a great text to kind of like speak to that notion of like what happens if something dramatic happens here, or we have a disaster, or we have some sort of a flu or something that comes through. And so the hospital is on board, and public health, and the symphony is going to do some music for that. Sort of think about, you know, what the symphony in the book is playing, and we're going to do some Shakespeare readings, and so there'll be lots of different things, some films that'll we'll show at the Goldtown Nickelodeon, also at the university. So there's just a whole slew of programming that's going to go along with this, as well as book discussions. So if you have a book group out there and you want to add this to your book group list, we've got free copies to hand out, and we've got book discussions that you can come to at the library, or you can hold your own book discussion. There's resources available for having questions in the back of the book, as well as on different websites. And since we're partnered up with the universities, One Campus, One Book, Jonas out there has made a great website to sort of collect all this information about the events in the book and the different things that you might connect to the resources for the book.
at bigreadjuno.org.
bigreadjuno.org. And we're talking about the Community Read, One Campus, One Book as well. And the book is Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. And I'm not a person who typically would read a book of that genre, which means a little bit...
post-apocalyptic.
Post-apocalyptic. I can think of some, but I will tell you I was completely drawn in by her approach. And as you said, a lot of the story is conveyed through this traveling troupe and around Michigan, of all places. And I encourage folks, grab the book now. It sounds like there will be a lot of terrific activities, and you can find out more at bigread.com.
BigReadJuno.
BigReadJuno.org. .org.
Or come to our website and you can get there from
BigReadJuno.org. This is why I have to write things down. Anything else you'd like to alert us to as we travel further into September?
Just, it's a great time to snuggle up with a book, so I'm encouraging you to read Station 11. We'll have our kickoff closer to the end of the month, so look for different information about that, as well as all the programming that's going to happen throughout the month of October.
Exciting music and speakers around that theme. Robert?
You know, and also we have a lot of, you know, I'm cognizant to the fact that we're talking on radio right now, so obviously if you're listening, you enjoy listening. And Station 11, we have a fantastic audiobook. If you go to our website and go to ebooks and downloadable audiobooks, the reader for Station 11 is phenomenal.
Great advice.
Another way to
it never crossed my mind. Yeah, that the version that you might be able to listen to would be exceptional.
That's really
and
great.
How difficult is that to download something?
It's become easier and easier. So it used to be hard. If you've tried to download audiobooks from the library and it was years ago and you got frustrated with the experience, I would encourage you to try it again, because it's a lot easier than it used to be. We just released a new app that makes it even simpler.
You could do it on your phone, then.
You can. I'm listening to it right now on my phone.
Exciting. Yeah. Well, thanks to Robert Barr, Director of the Juneau Public Libraries, and Program Coordinator Beth Weigel. As always, it's happening at the library. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now is a great time to renew your season tickets for the Juneau Symphony. Join conductor Troy Quinn. Be transformed, be inspired, and be here. Renewals are available now and will hold your seats until September 26th. After that, season tickets are available for everyone. You'll get tickets to our four main stage concerts and our symphony showcase. Contact the office at 586-4676 to enjoy live symphonic music at its finest. More information at junosymphony.org.
This is Bird Note. Enormous white birds soar gracefully in close formation against an azure sky, wingtip to wingtip. Circling ever higher toward a scattering of clouds, these giants have as long a wingspan as any birds on the continent. Are they eagles, vultures, cranes? They are American white pelicans. Spread wide, their wings measure a full 9 feet tip to tip, nearly that of the California condor. American white pelicans seem to drift without effort on updrafts. They glisten snowy white, except for their black flight feathers. When standing on a sandbar, American white pelicans look ponderous. Their comically oversized yellow-orange beaks are a near match to their huge orange feet. They simply dwarf any brown pelicans alongside, standing a full head taller. In summer, these birds breed mainly in the interior west of the United States and Canada. They favor shallow portions of large lakes, marshes, and rivers, where they scoop fish from the water in the pouches of their beaks. Loads of fish, because a pelican chick may eat 150 pounds worth before it leaves the nest. See photos and videos of American white pelicans when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
The 2017 Juneau Health Fair is coming to the Nugget Mall on September 16th from 8 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Take advantage of free education from local and regional wellness providers, health screenings, and the most affordable comprehensive blood tests in Alaska. Get the complete picture with one of the wellness packages or order tests individually. It's an easy way to stay on top of your health. More information about the health fair and available screenings at alaskahealthfair.org.
And thanks for staying with us on a Juno afternoon. My last guest today is Natalie Watson. She is with the Prevention Department of AWARE, and she's coordinating the girls' run and the boys' run. Hi, Natalie. Tell us about that.
Oh, I'm happy to. So these are empowerment programs for kids that incorporate running, and they also have a lot of life lessons. They teach healthy communication and self-respect and giving back to the community, and then it all ends with a 5K run.
What are the ages you're targeting?
For girls on the run, we do 3rd through 8th grade, and for boys, it's 3rd through 5th.
And do you need coaches for that, or does AWARE provide that?
Well, we found a lot of wonderful coaches in the community, but we always need a few more, and it's kind of getting close to crunch time. Our boys run coach training is September 16. We just had our girls on the run coach training, but we can do makeups, and we would love to have just a few more coaches to round out our teams.
And do you have room for lots of kids, or are those slots?
Yes.
Oh, you do.
It
okay.
Looks like right now we have room for lots of kids, but the deadline is this Thursday. So, yeah, sign up now. So for girls on the run, they can sign up at gotrgreateralaska.org.
G-O-T-R.
Yeah, Girls on
girls
the
on
Run.
The run.
Yes.
Dot org.
Yeah, get involved and then register your girl. For Boys Run, you can email me. I'm at nataliew@awareak.org, or you can sign up through your school counselor. We're running it at Harborview and Montessori this season.
So kids from other schools can or cannot participate?
For boys, well, they could, but they'd have to go to those schools. So it'll be Tuesdays and Thursdays after school at those schools.
Oh, being held there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they'd have to come there for the practice
then. They
would
indeed, uh-huh.
We're talking with Natalie Watson of AWARE about the Girls on the Run and the Boys Run program offered through AWARE to help build youth strength. And do you have a phone number, Natalie?
I do indeed. 586-4902.
586-4902. Thursday is the deadline to get your young girl grades 3 through 8 signed up and your boys grades 3 through 5 for the running program through AWARE. And thank you for staying with us on a Juno afternoon. On a Juno afternoon tomorrow, Shelley Delaney will be the host, Amy Skillbred from the Juno Community Foundation, and Michelle Frederico from Gastineau Human Services will be here to highlight residential treatment programs. Sam Bornstein will give us an update on makerspace activities, and Shannon Hasty and Hillary Young will be here to focus on Juno suicide prevention. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more on a Juno afternoon, Monday through Friday.